our lecturer, George Lewis Agamalian of New York, now on tour as a member of the Christian Science Board of Lectureship, is well qualified to speak from the viewpoint of Christian Science. Mr. Agamalian, who attended Columbia University, served in the 8th Air Force during World War II when he was awarded the Air Medal with 4 bronze oak leaf clusters. In 1950, he went to Europe on a Christian Science Youth Forum travel ship, during which he spoke to the youth in 6 countries. In 1951, he entered the healing public practice of Christian Science, and in 1964, became a teacher of Christian Science. Now we shall hear his discussion of a very timely subject under the title of More Than a Superstar. It is my pleasure to present Mr. Agamalian.
Thank you, Mrs. Childs, for that splendid introduction. And I wish to thank Mr. Givens for the inspiring organ music tonight. And good evening, friends. What is your concept of a superstar? Would it be a man who was born in an obscure village? The child of a peasant woman who grew up in another obscure village? Who worked in a carpenter shop until he was 30, and then for 3 years was an itinerant preacher? Would it be a man who never wrote a book, who never held an office, who never owned a home, who never had a family, who never went to college, who never put his foot inside a big city, who never traveled 200 miles from the place where he was born? Would this be your concept of a superstar? These are points the Reverend James A. Francis makes in his brief essay, One Solitary Life. And of course, he's referring to Jesus. Reverend Francis concludes his description of Jesus with these words: 19 wide centuries have come and gone, and today he is the centerpiece of the human race and the leader of the column of progress. I am far within the mark when I say that all the armies that ever marched and all the navies that ever were built and all the parliaments that ever sat and all the kings that ever reigned put together have not affected the life of man upon this earth as powerfully as has that one solitary life. Just think, Jesus had none of the human credentials that we usually associate with a superstar. Yet, as Reverend Francis states, no one has affected or changed human thinking more than he has. In the motion picture, Jesus Christ Superstar, Mary Magdalene sings about Jesus, "I don't know how to love him, what to do, how to move him. I've been changed, yes, really changed, in these past few days. When I've seen myself, I seem like someone else." Yes, Jesus really changes the life of Mary Magdalene. Here's a woman with 7 devils. We don't know exactly what that means, but No doubt she's deeply immersed in fleshly thinking. Now she comes face to face with Jesus of Nazareth. Perhaps she comes out of curiosity to see this strange young teacher who is healing the sick, helping the poor, and rebuilding broken lives. And then again, maybe it's more than curiosity that brings her. There may be a deep yearning within her to change her life and begin anew. There must be something within her thinking that wants to change, because meeting Jesus is making Mary Magdalene a completely new person. Think of the love and tenderness Jesus shows her by not ignoring her or condemning her. He isn't telling her it's too late. He isn't saying that there are others more worthy of his help. No, indeed, Jesus is changing her life so completely that Mary is to be the first to behold him at the tomb on the morning of his resurrection. Her life is so thoroughly transformed for the better that even before his own mother or his disciples, Mary Magdalene is to see the risen Jesus. This is a beautiful example of Jesus showing how God is always willing to help and forgive his children. No wonder he called them our Father. No sin is so great, no past so black, no condition too late for God to heal. For Jesus to have so completely changed Mary's life, he'd have to truly be a superstar in the highest sense of the word. But to also heal the sick of incurable diseases, to even raise the dead, he'd have to be more than a superstar. I've already mentioned that Jesus never did any of the things we usually associate with human greatness. And yet he has done more to influence the thinking and lives of men, women, and children than any other person in the history of mankind. Why? His Christliness. Let's talk about that for a minute. Some people use the name Christ interchangeably with Jesus. However, in Christian Science, we make a clear distinction between Jesus the human being and Christ, which is the truth, divine truth. We don't think of the Christ as a fleshly man with a robe and beard. To put it simply, Jesus was the most spiritually minded man who ever lived, whereas the Christ is the truth that motivated everything he thought and did. And because Jesus identified himself with the Christ truth so completely, he was given the title Christ Jesus. When Jesus made that profound statement to the Pharisees, "Before Abraham was, I am," obviously he wasn't talking of his physical body. He couldn't have been, because Abraham lived centuries before Jesus. He was referring to the Christ, which is never born and never dies. The Christ exists throughout eternity as an ever-present divine influence in human affairs. We can glimpse somewhat how this is through the definition of the Christ in the Christian Science textbook, Science and Health, with Key to the Scriptures by Mary Baker Eddy. Here, the discoverer and founder of Christian Science writes, Christ, the divine manifestation of God, which comes to the flesh to destroy incarnate error. The divine manifestation of God, which comes to the flesh to destroy incarnate error. Since the Christ is God's manifestation, we of course need to know what is meant by God. Again, we turn to Science and Health and find this definition. God is incorporeal, divine, supreme, infinite mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, love. Here we see God is incorporeal, not in a fleshly body. And God is truth. Therefore, it logically follows that God's manifestation, the Christ, is the very expression of truth and not dependent on a fleshly body. How does Christ manifest God? Let's apply those terms for God just mentioned. The Christ is spiritual illumination that comes from divine mind. The Christ is the healing presence of spirit. The Christ speaks through the spiritual senses of the one infinite soul, which is God. It operates as the divine law of spirit. It is the way or path of life. It is the still small voice of truth. It is the shepherding presence of love. So we see that the Christ can be thought of as spiritual illumination, healing presence, the divine law, the way, and the still small voice. Earlier, I mentioned how Mary Magdalene in Jesus Christ Superstar sings, I don't know how to love him. She doesn't know how to love him because she doesn't understand the Christ. Instead, she looks to a human personality. She thinks of Jesus as humanly originating the ability to change people's lives. She had to learn of Jesus' unseen spiritual identity. One of Mrs. Eddy's greatest contributions to this age is the new emphasis and divinity she brought to the distinction between Jesus the man and Christ or divine truth. Christian Science clearly explains it was his Christliness that inspired and governed every thought and action of Jesus. And it is this Christliness that can do the same for us. Jesus came to show us how to understand the Christ, the true idea of God and man, and of man's relationship to God. Mary Baker Eddy also caught this Christly light and explains it scientifically in her writings. Mrs. Eddy herself healed people solely through her understanding of the Christ truth. One such incident took place when Mrs. Eddy lived in Boston. a deformed and withered cripple, was sitting in a wheelchair in a Boston park one morning when Mrs. Eddy walked by. Touched by Christly compassion and tenderness, she went over to the man and told him that man is God's perfect child. You can imagine what a startling statement this would be to a lifelong invalid to be told that man is God's perfect child. He could have answered, well, if I'm God's perfect child, why does God let me sit in this chair suffering every day? But he didn't ask Mrs. Eddy why he had to suffer. When you ask why, you may become a whiner. No, he responded to Mrs. Eddy's recognition that he was God's perfect child. He must have glimpsed, however dimly, the Christ truth that Mrs. Eddy imparted, because he felt somewhat better at once. Then one day, Mrs. Eddy met him again while he was in his wheelchair. And again she told him that man is God's perfect child. This time he was healed and able to use his limbs freely. In fact, he was able to go into business for himself. Now, what really took place when Mrs. Eddy healed this man? It was the Christ within her finding a response from the Christ within him. Whatever the evidence presented to the physical senses, Mrs. Eddy thought in terms of perfect God and perfect man. Her standard was to always acknowledge present perfection. Always acknowledge present perfection. Mrs. Eddy knew that the healing Christ activates, strengthens, and supports all of our functions. And consequently, this crippled man was released from withered, deformed thinking, whether his own or that of mankind generally. Let's say he not only was God's perfect child, that is to say, God's perfect spiritual expression and likeness, but now he knew it and began to act like it. I like to think that Mrs. Eddy, as it were, took that word invalid and divided it into two words, invalid. Through her understanding of the Christ truth, she made invalidism invalid, exercising neither power nor authority. And this same Christ truth that healed the man in the wheelchair many years ago is just as present or available to heal you and me tonight. My own experience in learning more about the healing Christ came in my boyhood in just the kind of way that would appeal to a young boy. My brother, sisters, and I were taught to love Jesus and to follow his teachings. But we were also taught that the outstanding healing works performed by him were miracles, and that it would be rare for anyone else to heal the sick solely through prayer. But when I was 11, my mother enrolled us in the Christian Science Sunday School. I began to be taught that the works performed by Jesus were done as an example for us to do. He's our way shower, our teacher. He expected us to do his works. The design on the cover of Science and Health was pointed out to me. It's Jesus' words encircling the cross and crown. They read, heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the lepers, cast out demons. I was taught that Jesus expected us to do his works, and that they aren't miraculous, but typical of the Christ. Was this an awakening compared to my former teachings? Well, it wasn't long afterwards that I had an opportunity to prove what I was learning. I was barely a teenager and had a newspaper out. One afternoon, while delivering my papers, I met a customer walking her dog. The dog wasn't on a leash. And as we chatted, the animal walked into the middle of the street and was quickly run over by a fast-moving car. From all indications, the dog was killed. The woman became hysterical. She managed to carry the body to a nearby veterinarian's office. And as I was very fond of dogs, I went with her. The veterinarian took one look at the animal and said, I'm afraid there's nothing I can do. The woman became all the more hysterical. She kept saying, it's my son's dog. He'll never forgive me. The veterinarian took her into his private office to quiet her. I was left alone with the dog, and without any hesitation, began to pray for it. Now the presence of the Christ began to flood my thinking, and I found myself going over what we refer to as the scientific statement of being, which appears in Science and Health. Slowly, I went over it. There is no life, truth, intelligence, nor substance in matter. All is infinite mind and its infinite manifestation. For God is all in all. Spirit is immortal truth. Matter is mortal error. Spirit is the real and eternal. Matter is the unreal and temporal. Spirit is God, and man is his image and likeness. Therefore, man is not material. He is spiritual. Now, I didn't doubt for a moment that my praying in this way would resuscitate the dog. I had been taught in the Sunday school that the scientific statement of being applied to all being. I knew it was just as effective in healing an animal as it was in healing a person. Within a few minutes, the dog began to stir. She started to raise herself on her hind legs. You can imagine my joy and gratitude to God when I saw the dog getting up. At this point, the veterinarian came out with the lady. He was amazed to see the dog recovering. I left them with the feeling of certainty that the animal was healed. A few days later, I had to go to this lady's home to collect the weekly bill for the newspapers. As I entered, the dog came running to me barking. She was perfectly healed. And running behind her was a group of puppies. I didn't know it, but she had a litter of puppies prior to the accident. I've often thought that the dog herself must have had a desire to live and care for her family. This was an added healing impetus for her recovery. Now, I mentioned how the Christ truth filled my thinking while praying for the dog. It's the spiritual presence of the Christ, when understood and felt, that heals all fleshly conditions. This presence is the power of God, divine life. Your true identity and mine is included in the Christ. It's composed of Christ-like qualities or thoughts, not animality or matter. The same Christ-like qualities of purity, dominion, and goodness that Jesus embodied belong to us also. Now, our job is to express these qualities as he did. If we don't make an effort to do so, if we don't obey the Christ within us, then in effect, we're betraying the Christ. The greatest betrayer of all was Judas Iscariot. Actually, Judas had as much access to the Christ truth as the other 11 disciples. But whereas their thinking was open in varying degrees to the divine manifestation of God, his was absorbed in a mortal material selfhood, a selfhood that claimed it lay apart from the Christ influence. You know, Judas-like thinking isn't personal. It would try to use all of us. But it isn't always so easy to detect. Judas-like thinking is derived from a belief in a mind apart from divine mind, God. It is derived from a supposed mortal material Adam man, apart from the man that Jesus came to prove. It would try to get us to betray the Christ in our everyday living. It uses suggestions such as, "Nothing much good ever happens to me. Others seem to get all the breaks. This is envy talking. It betrays the Christ within us." Or another suggestion, "I'm ill, and I may not regain my health. This is despair and fear talking. It betrays the Christ within us." Or the suggestion might be, "I need drugs or alcohol or tobacco for happiness and satisfaction. This attitude seeks matter gods. It betrays the Christ within us." So betrayal of the Christ, God's presence, comes in many forms and is very subtle. It would try to prevent us from seeing the full evidence of good. Let's not be deceived by Judas-like thinking. Refute it, and let it hang not you, but itself. There's a vivid illustration of how the Antichrist or Judas-like thinking deprived one individual of his good. You may be familiar with it. The story concerns Leonardo da Vinci and his painting of the Last Supper. As you probably recall, the painting shows Jesus seated at a table with his 12 disciples on the eve of his crucifixion. For a number of years, Da Vinci was unable to complete his masterpiece because he was unable to find anyone to use as a model for Jesus, for Judas. He was able to find people to model for the other 11 disciples and also for Jesus, but not Judas. Da Vinci was even given permission to enter the prisons to find a face like Judas among the inmates, but none satisfied him. So for some 11 years, he kept looking. Then one night, he was sitting in a tavern eating. And as he looked up, he saw a man eating at another table. And his expression prompted him to think, "There's my Judas." He went over to the man and introduced himself and explained that he'd like to have him portray Judas Iscariot for his painting. The man smiled and said, "Don't you remember me?" Da Vinci replied, "No." He then told him that 11 years earlier, he had sat for him when he painted Jesus. He explained how in the intervening years, he'd had many hardships and become bitter. During this time, his beautiful countenance of a Jesus was transformed into the dark expression of a Judas. This man literally let negative Judas-like thinking misshape his face. He betrayed his own inner Christ-like nature. Now, let's look at the other side of the coin. How responding to the Christ influence can bring good into our lives. Let me illustrate with my own experience of being healed of illness through understanding my Christly nature. Before becoming a Christian Science practitioner, I managed a business in New York City. One morning while going to work on the subway, I became very ill. I thought I was going to black out. I got off the train and sat on a station bench and began praying. Now, physical healing in Christian Science is the effect of applying spiritual truths to our human situation. Healing is the effect of divine ideas coming to human consciousness. This is the Christ in action. And as a result, the body, which is only a product of thought, is harmonized or healed. So I didn't plead, but rather prayed affirmatively, knowing I was God's perfect child, well and free. I vigorously declared that God's presence was available to help me in this moment of need. However, the more I prayed, the worse I felt. Then fearful suggestions began to argue, "I'd better get home quickly and get to bed. I'm very sick. Something awful might happen." I rejected this argument as untrue. Mrs. Eddy writes, "If God is all, and God is good, it follows that all must be good, and no other power, law, or intelligence can exist." Unquote. This leaves no room for an opposite power named evil. In Christian Science, we often use the term error. for this supposed opposite of truth. It denotes an illusion or misconception. You recall that Jesus called evil or the devil a lie. When discussing error with my Sunday school pupils at home, I asked them to turn to page 500 of Science and Health and read to me what it says about error. Well, when they arrive at page 500, they find, much to their amazement, a blank page. I tell them that's the best way to think of error or evil as nothing. Page 500. And don't write anything on that page either. A lady came up to me recently after the lecture and she said, "You know, I've always thought that all the diseases of the world are listed on page 500. Now let's get back to the subway station. With great fervor and humility, I prayed, "Dear Father, give me some thought that will help me." Instantly, the thought came, 2 times 2 equals 4, not 5. My first reaction was, what does that have to do with my problem? And I rejected it. But again the thought came, 2 times 2 equals 4, not 5. Then I began to analyze this statement. Now this is the way the Christ works in our thinking. It comes as spiritual illumination or enlightenment to meet our human needs in a practical way. In this instance, the Christ revealed itself with the words, 2 times 2 equals 4, not 5. As I pondered the idea, it came clearly that the 4 was the right answer, while the 5 was a mistake. Similarly, the correct solution to my problem was that I am now the perfect, healthy child of God. This, in effect, was like the 4 or the truth. It was the fact. Further enlightenment came in a very interesting manner. I saw that as the 4 was the correct answer mathematically to the equation, in the same way, the opening of Genesis in the Bible was the true answer about me. Within the first chapter of Genesis, there are 3 key points about man. They are: man is created in God's image and likeness. Man has dominion over all the earth. And God saw everything that he had made as very good. We can summarize these statements with 3 words: image, dominion, good. This was the fact about me. However, that illness in the subway station was like the 5, a mistake, a lie. It was like the 2nd chapter of Genesis, which describes man as not made in God's spiritual image, but of dust, of matter. This misconception of man, or shall we say, missed conception of man, leads only to problems. Well, you know, as soon as I caught a glimpse of my identity as spiritual and free, all physical distress and fear left. I felt it draining from my body. I boarded another train and arrived at my place of business entirely well. The Christ, God's presence, can always make itself felt through prayer in a practical, effective way. It's just as present on a crowded New York subway station as it was on the quiet shores of the Galilean Sea 2,000 years ago. And it's just as present or available on the most crowded thoroughfares here in Alameda or in your homes or offices or schoolrooms as it was on the quiet shores of the Galilean Sea 2,000 years ago. As we open our human consciousness or thinking to this spiritual influence, as we obey the Christ instead of betraying it, it harmonizes every step of our human experience. This then is the coincidence of the divine with the human. The Christ is that indestructible bond or spiritual agreement or oneness between God and us. The motivating force or law called the Christ, which lay behind Jesus' mighty works, is still here governing each of us. This is why Jesus himself said, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, he that believeth on me, the works that I do, shall he do also." Scriptural authority. We too can perform the healing works of Spirit in the degree that we, like Jesus, apply divine truth to our human thinking. Now, this next part is important. The Christ is our Savior. That which saves or heals, it is God's saving aspect. It's the divine presence that heals disease, because the Christ includes perfect health. It's the presence that heals sorrow, because the Christ includes eternal joy. It's the presence that heals fear and depression, because the Christ includes enduring peace and courage. It's the presence of abundance, because the Christ includes God's unending goodness. Our Savior, the Christ, is with us this very moment. Let's humbly open our thinking to it. Now let's go back in history to that Friday in Jerusalem, as Jesus is trudging beneath the weight of the cross. The crowds are surging and pushing for a glimpse of this man that Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor, has sentenced to be crucified. At one point, Jesus falls to the ground. The soldiers pull a man out of the crowd to carry the cross the rest of the way. We learn that his name is Simon of Cyrene. Just think, this one man in all history is being chosen to share the weight of the cross up to Calvary. The Christ thinking within Jesus must have touched the Christ thinking within Simon for him to be chosen to assist the Master up to Calvary. Actually, the Roman soldiers didn't choose Simon, but rather the Christ did. But you know, in a way, we're all Simons. We all carry something of a cross. Didn't Jesus say to each of us, "If any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me." But the cross isn't a symbol of defeat or sorrow or heaviness, but of victory. Victory over sin. Victory over disease. And victory over death through the Christ. To take up the cross is to rejoice in God's healing presence. To take up and mentally deny all the false suggestions of materialism and mortality. It's through taking up this burden of joy that we prove that Christ conquers sin. The Christ destroys disease. And the Christ abolishes death. Now the long ascent up to Calvary is finished. And Jesus is nailed between two common thieves. What an ending for a superstar of his magnitude. The greatest exponent of the Christ the world has ever known. Then one of the thieves begins to scold Jesus. He says, "If thou be the Christ, save thyself and us." The Master is silent. The other thief rebukes his fellow criminal sharply and says to Jesus, "Lord, remember me when thou comest into thy kingdom." He replies with compassion, "Verily I say unto thee, today shalt thou be with me in paradise." Today, right now, Jesus offers us, as he did the thief, paradise, Christ-like bliss. In effect, he's saying there's nothing to wait for. Some of us, like the first thief, may want to be released and go back to our former ways. This represents the past. Others of us, like the second thief, may typify the future. We may be looking for a future heaven or security. But the Master symbolizes the present, God's nowness. He says, "Today shalt thou be with me in paradise." With the crucifixion of Jesus, it would appear that his 3-year ministry of the Christ truth was in vain. He failed. But we know better. This was only the beginning of his most convincing proof of all, the resurrection. On the third day after his crucifixion, he came out from the tomb. He came out not in an exhibition of personal power, but rather in evidence of the Christ power. He proved that life is indestructible. They had taken this physical body called Jesus, lashed it, crucified it, speared it, entombed it. But he proved through his understanding of the Christ truth that life is God, not structural or physical, never to be destroyed. Yes, the resurrection is a solid proof of the eternality of life. The ascension, the concluding chapter in Jesus' earthly life, was his final dropping off of materiality, of all limitation. It took place some 40 days after the resurrection. It was his final victory over all doctrines of false theology, all the arguments of material medicine, and all the laws of physical science. It unveiled the science of the Christ, the science of the true idea of God and man. God as spirit, and man as his infinite spiritual idea. The Master said, and I'm quoting again from the Bible, "No man hath ascended up to heaven, but he that came down from heaven, even the Son of Man, which is in heaven." The ascension doesn't start from limited earthly thinking, but from unlimited heavenly knowing. The Christ man, the you and me of God's creating, this Christ man has never left the consciousness of heaven. We've never left heaven. Yes, the crucifixion coupled with the resurrection and ascension has the deepest significance for us all. It's more than the experience of the human Jesus and his triumph, as important as that is, but it's much more than that. It's proof of the eternal Christ, Emmanuel, God with us. It's reality brought to light. The true import of the crucifixion, resurrection, and ascension is stated in a tenet of the First Church of Christ Scientists, founded by Mrs. Eddy. This tenet reads, "We acknowledge that the crucifixion of Jesus and his resurrection served to uplift faith, to understand eternal life, even the allness of soul, spirit, and the nothingness of matter." I was never more aware of this than when I walked the Via Dolorosa, the sorrowful road or way of the cross, on a Good Friday. With hundreds of tourists in Jerusalem, I slowly mounted the same path that Jesus took up to Calvary. But unlike many of those around me, I didn't feel the sorrow of the crucifixion, but rather the joy and glory of the resurrection and ascension. I felt the gentle presence of the Christ, God's manifestation. Every time we humbly open our thinking to the Christ, to this healing presence, this divine law, every time we open our thinking to it and let it direct our lives, we're experiencing resurrection in some small measure. Let's make every day a resurrection experience. The Christ is ready. Are you?